Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Jonathan Sadowski, a professor of the history of medicine at Case Western Reserve University. And we're talking about his latest book, The Empire of Depression, A New History. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, well, it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm really honored to be a guest.
One of the things I realized reading this book is I want to read more well-written histories of medicine or medical conditions, because this made things a lot clearer, a lot more understanding. And writing as a historian, you don't take any sides. You don't have any agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's okay for historians to take sides. I'm not against polemical history, and certain things, I do have strong opinions about certain things. We can talk about what they are if you like. But I also think that history has a great potential to step back from debates a little bit and see how the debate itself was formed in time, over time. So I'll give you two examples of that. So for example, as you know, in the book, I make a lot out of the fact that depression shouldn't be regarded as a mind versus body problem or a talk versus medication problem, and that these things can complement one another instead of being in opposition. Why does history matter for this? It matters because it allows us to see that the debate itself has been repetitive. And I use the image in the end of it's like the mental health field has been like a married couple stuck in the same arguments for decades. And history gives you some perspective to see that. Another example comes from my work on electroconvulsive therapy, which is a therapy that's extremely controversial, with some people vilifying it as a form of abuse and other people plainly stating it's the most effective treatment in all of psychiatry. And the question for me, what animated my previous book about electroconvulsive therapy was to see, why did this debate get so polarized to begin with?
Part of that has to do, and you bring this out in the book, films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, and you know, Cuckoo's Nest is very much resented by practitioners who provide electroconvulsive therapy. But I do like to point out that the depiction in that movie, in that book, well, sensationalist in some ways, it wasn't completely unrealistic for the time that it was set. And Kesey had spent time in mental hospitals, and he had witnessed this. And there's no question that in the early decades of ECT particularly, it was used for coercive purposes. So I don't want to whitewash that history at all.
And you don't. You mention all aspects of that in the book and on several other topics, too. You're very clear where the controversies lie. But first of all, the administration of ECT has changed since the days of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The way that it's done, the way that the patient is approached to do it is very, very different.
Right. And it's, you know, most ECT given in the United States now is voluntary, and with muscle relaxants and anesthesia, it's much less unpleasant, although there is a continuing controversy over memory loss. And even many patients who have very much valued the treatment and said they would get it again have said that they regretted the memory loss, that was a you know, Carrie Fisher, for example,
right.
She wrote an eloquent book about this.
However, it has been a really effective treatment for depression.
It has been, absolutely. And this is another thing I'd like to emphasize, and it's something that I bring out also in the new book, In Empire of Depression, which is that it's important to listen to patients. It's important that patients be a part of the dialogue about medicine and part of the historical record about medicine. And that means listening to both sides of the patients. That means listening to patient complaints, for example, about adverse effects, whether from ECT or from medications. You have to take those complaints seriously. I gave examples in the new book about patients, for example, who complained about a certain adverse effect from an antidepressant medication, only to be dismissed by their doctor saying, oh, well, that's not in the manual, that doesn't happen.
Right.
In effect, saying that must be in your head. So you do need to take that seriously. At the same time, though, Mark, I do also want to stress that, you know, we as historians also have a responsibility to listen to patients who feel they've been helped by their treatment. And I think, speaking to any of my colleagues, there's a lot of real negativity about the psychiatric profession among historians of psychiatry. Not all, but many. And I felt that a complete account, not because balance is important by itself, but because the record really is ambiguous. Psychiatry has harmed people, but it's also alleviated a lot of suffering, and we need to recognize that.
In your book, throughout the 20th century especially, there seem to have been two main types of treatments for depression. The physical somatic treatments, which would be ECT and antidepressants, and then the psychological treatments, depth psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy. And for a lot of the 20th century, it seems like it was you had to choose one or the other. And one of the things your book points out is you don't have to choose.
Right. I believe that this is a false choice, and I think it's a choice that's been structured in part by the tendency of some professionals to emphasize only one or the other. And sometimes this breaks along simple professional lines, that is, people who do more psychological or talk therapy tend to devalue the physical treatments. And some psychiatrists who get very excited about the possibilities of biology and biological treatment may undervalue the psychological treatments. Actually, the best research shows that not only do you not have to choose, but sometimes in combination, they're the strongest. For example, Irving Kirsch, who's written a book highly critical of antidepressants, in my opinion, overly critical of antidepressants, although he's a smart man and he wrote a good book that I learned from. He wrote this book, The Emperor's New Drugs, about antidepressants. But even Irving Kirsch, who is very skeptical about the value of antidepressants, concedes that there's data that show that antidepressants work best in combination with psychotherapy, and that, in fact, the two work best together. I think another reason why this false division or false choice has come is that I think that for much of the 20th century, psychiatry has felt like it's chasing the rest of medicine. You have to remember, you know, in 1900, 120 years ago, we didn't have vaccines for the most part. We didn't have antibiotics. We were still really vulnerable to infectious disease. Now, of course, we learned this year that we're more vulnerable still than we'd like to think. But in 1918, when the flu hit, they weren't expecting a vaccine to come any minute then, right?
Right.
As we came to expect that would happen. So there were these great advances in treating infectious diseases, and you can look at other things, the development of insulin for diabetes, and the period from about 1850 to 1950, medicine was achieving powers of cure and prevention that were undreamed of in previous eras. And psychiatry wanted to catch up, and it also wanted to prove that it was scientific. And it's always had a kind of stepchild status within the medical profession. And so I think chasing biological treatments or emphasizing that biological treatments could work was a way for some psychiatrists to to present their what they did as medicine and to be a full member of the medical fold.
One of the things you bring up in the book, and I found this intriguing, is depression one thing, or should we be talking about depressions?
Yeah, I think probably it's not one thing. And one of the reasons that it's hard to talk about this is that we don't have clear demarcations. That is, we don't have a blood test that's going to tell you what kind of depression you have. And it probably is a family of illnesses more than a single illness. In fact, in practice, psychiatrists do recognize that there are different kinds of depression. Major depressive order is only one of the diagnoses that you can give under the DSM-5. But it's a little bit fuzzy. And we don't have, as I say, we don't have blood tests. One of the biggest distinctions that's often made, and was even more made in the mid-20th century, was the distinction between what psychiatrists called endogenous or exogenous depression. That is, endogenous being really biologically caused, maybe by genetics or underlying constitution, and exogenous being reactive. Reactive was the typical word used, meaning in response to events. I'm not really sure that that distinction is as clear as some have wanted to pose it. I think it's quite possible that many depressions are a combination of things, which is what many of the psychoanalytic theorists, by the way, thought. The psychoanalytic theorists have been caricatured in the sort of post-Freudian era. They've been caricatured as hostile to biology and only looking at the psychology. But most of them believed that actually there were underlying constitutional reasons for depression, but that those would be activated by certain circumstances. It's also important to recognize that, well, it's clear that certain kinds of stress, trauma, terrible life events can cause depression. The research doesn't show that everybody who has those adverse events is going to get a state that rises to the level of clinical depression. In fact, only a minority will. And this is one of the reasons why I insist in the book that depression does qualify as an illness. Many people might be listening to this and thinking, well, of course depression is an illness, but its status as an illness remains uncertain. You can go on psych Twitter any day of the week and find people saying, no, depression is just a normal, natural reaction to life.
Right.
It's just on continuity with regular life experience. And even people who suffer from very severe depressions are sometimes subject to that kind of doubt. Do I really have an illness? So I think you do. It's not only do we not have good ways of demarcating different kinds of depression, we don't have a hard and fast line between the ordinary experience of the hardness of life that causes sorrow, causes lack of interest, can sometimes even cause things like sleeplessness and lack of appetite or other symptoms of depression, and full-blown clinical depression. But the key point to me is that the existence of this continuity, the fact that we're talking about a spectrum instead of polar opposites where it's either one or the other, does not disqualify depression from the illness state. And I'd like to use an image to illustrate this. It was an image that one of my students used many years ago in a course I was teaching, and it stayed with me. The student said that she saw it like an archery target. And the bullseye of the archery target, if we think of that as severe depression, where you're in a catatonic state or nearly suicidal or can't get out of bed, very severe depression. And then maybe the rim, the outside edge, is more like, you know, the normal hardness of life that we have to all have to deal with. Now, what the student, I remember her name was Krista. And what Krista said was, you know, we're all on this target somewhere, but not everybody is on the part of the target where you can be sure that it's illness. Some people are in a kind of fuzzy state. And I don't think we should, it would be great. Clearly, it would be great if we had absolute clear markers that could delineate who is sick and who isn't. But I don't think the fact that we lack them means we should throw the illness status out the window.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jonathan Sadowski, professor of the history of medicine at Case Western Reserve University. And we're talking about his latest book, The Empire of Depression, A New History. Jonathan, there are two lists, as a matter of fact, diagnostic lists that are in your book. One of them is on page 4. And it's written like, if you have 5 of the 9 symptoms present on that list for 2 weeks, then you have clinical depression. Now, is that part of the diagnosis of this? Is that the duration of the symptoms?
Yeah, duration. Well, throughout history, clinical observers of depression have agreed that duration matters. What exactly the duration should be has been less clear. It changes from one society to another. It changes in one society over time. 2 weeks, to me, it sounds like a fairly arbitrary number.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a wrong number. I don't know what the right number is. And I'm not a clinical scientist. I'm a historian. So I sketch the ways these things change throughout time and try to explain the changes. It's not my job to say how long it is. But we do know, for example, take normal grieving, right?
Yeah.
Which nobody considers an illness. We all agree that you lose a spouse or somebody else close to you, you're going to grieve. But cultures differ in how long they expect you to grieve. In some places, a year would be normal. In some places, 2 years would be normal. But I think most of us would agree that if you've gone 5 years after the death of someone close to you, and you're still having trouble getting out of bed, and your appetite is bad, and you're having a bunch of these other symptoms, maybe you should get medical treatment. So again, the fact that the lines are arbitrary and necessarily arbitrary don't necessarily mean that we shouldn't be treating or medicating. I am not, by the way, I am not arguing that we should be throwing antidepressants at every person who suffers a loss. We are probably overusing antidepressants, but I do think that there may be other populations, particularly among the poor and underinsured, that are being undermedicated.
Right. And this brings up an interesting question, Jonathan, that you deal with in your book, and it's complex. Do all cultures have depression? Not just Western culture, or so-called Western culture, in the United States and Europe. When we talk about other parts of the world, is there depression? Is it manifested the same way?
Yeah, this is a very hard question to resolve. It's clearly becoming diagnosed in more parts of the world, but critics say that's only because of the hegemony of Western psychiatry,
right,
and it's spreading all over, and the pharmaceutical companies are promoting it, and the pharmaceutical companies are promoting it, and they are making money from the fact that people in parts of the world that used to have other language to describe distress are now calling it depression. You know, one thing you know from my book, Mark, is that I try to be clear about when I know something for sure and when I think something's really hard to decide.
That's right.
One thing that I think is really hard to decide is this question of cultural difference. I tend to lean towards the view that depression as an illness state is a human universal. Everyone agrees that depression as a mood is a human universal. Whether it's an illness in every society or every culture is very hard to resolve. The reason it's hard to resolve is that if you find it, you can always be accused of imposing a Western label on something that was understood differently. And if you don't find it, you can always be accused of not looking in the right way, or, you know, maybe there's a translation issue. So it's very complicated, but my own view, my gut feeling is that it's pretty close to a human universal.
And this brings up another question that you deal with well in the book. The historical aspects of depression is what people used to describe as melancholia. Is that simply depression?
Yeah, so this was also a very complicated question, and I spent a lot of time trying to sort it through. Sometimes I would be reading descriptions of melancholia, whether in antiquity or in the Renaissance or in the 19th century, I'd be reading descriptions and I'd say, this is simple. It just sounds completely like depression. You look at the symptoms, they all look the same. On the other hand, there were certain states that were described as melancholia that really didn't look as much like depression. There's an example I don't even remember whether it's in the book or not, but there was a delusional state where a patient imagined himself as a clay urn, right? Sounds like what we would now call a psychotic state. So is that depression? Well, you might say, well, no, that's psychosis. But it's important to remember that current psychiatry recognizes psychotic depression. That is, you can have depression with delusional states. Not all depression is only a disorder of mood. So, in the history of medicine as a field, there has been for some time a kind of taboo against what's called in the field retrospective diagnosis.
Right.
So that would be, for example, taking a patient who was labeled with consumption in the 18th century and say, oh, well, that person had tuberculosis. And there are some in the field, some of my colleagues, who are very, very averse to this retrospective diagnosis. You can only describe them in the language that was used for the time. You can't assume that our modern categories. I take that as a good caution against anachronism, and historians always want to avoid anachronism. But I think as a way of practicing medical history, it can shade from being a proper caution and into being a rigid taboo that does not allow us to make meaningful comparisons across time. And we know that there is a relationship between melancholia and depression because we know there was a deliberate attempt to rename melancholia as depression. It wasn't like the word depression came out of nowhere. If there was one man responsible, it was the psychiatrist Adolf Meyer. He didn't like melancholia as a word because it came from this humoral medicine background. It assumed black bile. And he said, we don't know the causes of this illness. Let's use a word that doesn't assume a cause.
And we're almost out of time, but it seems today I know so many more people who are being treated for depression. Is there a danger that depression is being overdiagnosed?
There definitely is a danger of depression being overdiagnosed. As I said, I mean, I think that, there are a lot of critics out there who are very worried about this and think we are just medicating the normal life distress. And I take that criticism seriously, but I try to push back at it a little bit. You know, in the mid-20th century, psychiatrists were much more concerned about underdiagnosis of depression. They were convinced there were many people out there in the community who were depressed and weren't coming into treatment. Right. Because their illness state wasn't recognized. Now, from the point of view of those people, we're only now seeing all of the people who need treatment. Is there some overdiagnosis? Are there some people being diagnosed who shouldn't be? Probably. But I think we also need to be mindful of the reduced suffering of many people who might not have been getting treatment 50, 60, 70 years ago.
And also,
and I don't think that only the most severe people, the people with, you know, near catatonia, for example, those aren't the only people who deserve treatment.
That's right. But there is a politics of inequality about depression. And it's based on poverty. It's based on money too. And you talk about that. We are almost out of time, but you talk about that's another aspect of the diagnosis of depression.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up before we finish, Mark, because I think that it's important to understand this. This is that that adverse situations, being part of a minority or persecuted group or being of a lower class group, is a risk for depression. This, by the way, is not another reason to treat it as a non-illness. There is a politics to all illness. There's a politics to COVID. There's a politics to AIDS. There's a politics to tuberculosis. And we would never dream of withholding treatment for COVID or AIDS or tuberculosis simply because poor people were more likely to get them. We might in practice, but that would be malpractice.
We're completely out of time, and there is so much more. We've only scratched the surface of this book. It's an amazing read. It's clinical and it's scientific, historical, but it's also a great read. My guest tonight has been Jonathan Sadowski, professor in the history of medicine at Case Western Reserve University. And we've been talking about his latest book. I really recommend it, The Empire of Depression, A New History. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.